Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Senator Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history, and discuss the Republican budget, which passed the Senate on a party-line vote that repeals the Affordable Care Act, throws extra money at the Pentagon, and repeals the estate tax, even though only 3,700 estates valued at over $5.43 million or $11 million for a couple are subject to the tax, which means the richest 0.12% will now pay no estate tax. We will discuss a number of issues, including the 2016 Democratic presidential primary debates that so far look more like a monologue than a dialogue. Then we will speak with Lena Hatib, who's the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut, about a possible hidden motive behind Saudi intervention in Yemen that might result in a military occupation of the south of the country to secure the port of Aden and its oil terminals so that Saudi oil could be piped directly to Asian customers from terminals on the Indian Ocean, thus bypassing the Gulf and the Iranian-dominated Straits of Hormuz. Then finally, we will speak with an instrument-rated pilot and author of Free Flight from Airline Hell to a New Age of Travel. Award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic, James Fallows, joins us to discuss his article in The Atlantic, Could the German Wings Crash Have Been Avoided? And joining us now is Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history and sits on the Veterans Committee and was tapped by Senate leadership to be the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. He also serves on the Environment and Public Works and the Energy and Natural Resources, the Joint Economic, and on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees. Welcome to Background Briefing, Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good to be with you.
And the Republican Senate just passed a budget along party lines that repeals the Affordable Care Act, throws extra money at the Pentagon, and repeals the estate tax, even though only 3,700 estates valued at over $5.43 million or $11 million for a couple are subject to the tax. And this means that the richest 0.12% will now pay no state tax. Surely that budget reveals the real priorities of this Republican Senate.
Ian, it is such a disastrous budget that if you try to explain it to the American people, I think that they would have a hard time believing you. They would think you're not telling the truth or that you're being partisan. But for a start, when the Republicans decide to repeal the Affordable Care Act and cut $440 billion in Medicaid, what they are doing, and no one argues this, they are throwing 27 million Americans off of health insurance. Now, what really disturbs me is not just that they have done that, is that we have seen very little media coverage of that reality, throwing 27 million Americans off of health insurance at a time when we're the only country in the world that doesn't guarantee, major country, that doesn't guarantee health care to all people. The second thing that they do, which is a disaster, is all over this country, in Vermont and California, working class families are struggling mightily to try to figure out how they're going to send their kids to college. College is outrageously expensive. Young people are leaving school deeply in debt. The Republican solution to that reality is to cut $90 billion over a 10-year period in mandatory Pell Grant funding. And that is, Pell Grants are the major source of federal grants to low and moderate income students for a college education. So the Republican budget makes it even harder for working class kids to go to college. Right now in America, we have over 40 million people who are living in poverty because as the middle class disappears, more and more people slipping into poverty. And a lot of those people are working families who, after working hard, still don't have enough money to put food on the table. And they need food stamps, and they need other nutrition programs. Republican budget decimates nutrition programs in this country. And then, as you've indicated, to add insult to injury, after telling us that we have to make all of these horrendous cuts because of the deficit, well, they add another $38 billion to the military without paying for it. That means it's on, adds to the deficit, it's on the credit card. And then, as you mentioned, they say to the wealthiest people in this country, the top 0.1%, they say, well, you don't have to pay any more estate taxes. So, you know, it is a budget that is obviously geared to represent the wealthy and the powerful, and it continues the war against the middle class and working families, and that's where we are.
And it would seem to me, though, under current conditions, the only way that we can have any programs in this country that actually help the American people, since you can't raise taxes, obviously that's a non-starter. So the only places where you can get money, where there's money being poured in and wasted, as far as I can see, is the military budget, the prison industrial complex, and the failed war on drugs. And it seems to me by throwing extra money at the Pentagon, the Republicans are basically trying to foreclose the only option that we have, which is to find some money for the people of this country.
Well, Leon, I will not give up the fight to make certain that the wealthiest people in this country, who are doing unbelievably well, and large corporations who in many cases are enjoying record-breaking profits, I will not give up the fight to demand that they pay their fair share of taxes. We are losing about $100 billion every single year because corporations are stashing their money in the Cayman Islands and Bermuda, other tax havens, and that has got to change. Warren Buffett, one of the richest people in America, was honest enough to point out that his effective, i.e. real tax rate, is lower than his secretary's, and that's totally absurd. So we're not going to give up the fight for a fair and progressive tax system. But your point is that the Republicans, at a time when the Department of Defense can't even audit itself, when there are huge cost overruns, we're talking about tens and tens of billions of dollars, and their response is to throw more money at the Pentagon, an additional $38 billion off budget.
So when you, under these conditions, it would seem to me that the press ought to be focusing on this really brazen effort on the part of the Republicans to let the richest 0.12% of Americans not pay estate taxes, which has been the case for decades. That, to me, really is so brazen and is such a flag that I'm surprised that nobody's noticed it, because you cannot hide the intentions behind it and the priorities that it represents.
No, I think, you know, when you look at what's going on in the country today, I mean, I think most people perceive that the major institutions, corporate America, the political system, and media, by the way, and corporate-owned media, have failed the American people. I mean, you're seeing today in America economically an unbelievable level of income and wealth inequality. Just a study that came out recently, if I may just mention it, that pointed out that between 2013 and 2015, if you can believe this is Forbes magazine, the top 14 wealthiest people in this country, 14 people, saw their wealth increase by $157 billion in that two-year period. $157 billion, 14 people. That $157 billion is more wealth than is owned by the bottom 40% of the American people, approximately 130 million people. That's the kind of incredible income and wealth inequality. And then people look at the politics of America, and they perceive quite correctly, and you've just described the budget, that the budget and legislation passed in the Congress does not reflect the needs of the American people. It represents what the billionaire class wants. And then you get to the media, and, you know, you would think that your point, that at a time when the rich are becoming much richer, the Republicans vote to repeal the estate tax, impacting just a handful of people. At the same time, by the way, as they're raising taxes on low-income and moderate-income people in this budget by repealing the extension of the earned income tax credit. You would think that maybe there would be some major stories about that, but I don't expect that there will be, and that's just the reality that we have to deal with.
So, Senator Sanders, as we approach this next election year, of course, at this point, in terms of, there's an awful lot of Republicans have entered the race. Ted Cruz has already thrown his hat in, and others will follow in the next few weeks. On the Democratic side, it looks that basically at this point we're going to have a monologue and not a dialogue.
Well, we will see about that. Ian, as I have said many times, I am giving a thought to running for president. We're here in California today and just had an event, which was a wonderful event, many hundreds of people coming out. And we're seeing that kind of response all over the country.
Well, let me just interject here and point out that I'll be emceeing an event with you at 2 p.m. today at the Musicians Union at 817 Vine Street in Hollywood. And people are certainly welcome to come, and I encourage people to come and meet with Senator Bernie Sanders at 2 p.m. today at the Musicians Union Hall at 817 Vine Street in Hollywood. Go ahead.
Well, thank you. We had a great event last night. And what I'm trying to ascertain is when you run a campaign, the likes of the campaign I would run if I decided to do it, you're taking on everybody. You're taking on the Koch brothers and Wall Street and the military-industrial complex and the drug companies. And it's quite an undertaking. And I just want to sense that before I make that decision, there is grassroots support all over this country for on the part of people who are willing to take on the billionaire class and you know, to determine whether or not we could raise the kinds of money we need to run a credible campaign. So that's kind of where I am right now.
But that landscape is not without hazards, given that Republicans still blame Ross Perot for Bill Clinton being elected over George H.W. Bush, and many people blame what happened down in Florida, where essentially the intervention on the part of Ralph Nader siphoned off enough votes from Al Gore, I think 96,000, and Al Gore lost by 517 votes in Florida. So, you know, doing the math there, there is a, you know, a problem in American politics where third parties tend to, you know, with the domination of the two main parties, tend to make third parties, whether they want to be or not, spoilers.
Right. Well, that's one of the calculations that we have to make. As you know, I am the longest serving independent in the history of the Congress and was elected by the people of Vermont as an independent, but I have been caucusing with the Democrats since I've been in the House and for the last 8 years in the Senate. So one of the decisions that I do have to make is whether you run within the Democratic primary system or whether you run outside of it.
Well, my sense, though, just in terms of the health of the country and the health of, I mean, obviously, you know, the more diversity in a debate, the better. And at this point, as I say, we have a monologue, not a dialogue. And that's unacceptable. But also what I find unacceptable, and I'm absolutely puzzled why it continues unabated, and that is the poisonous nature of the political debate in the country. The extent to which the Republican right have essentially given the American people the permission to hate the President of the United States, who is not, he's not Richard Nixon. He's not a divisive character.
No, he is not. He's quite the contrary.
He's a man who's trying to do the best that he can. And I don't for the life of me understand this.
Well, I'll tell you why. When you have an ideology and an agenda which is bankrupt, when you have an agenda, as we've just discussed from the Republican budget, which gives huge tax breaks to the very, very richest people in this country, at the same time as you throw 27 million Americans off of health insurance and cut back on education and nutrition and affordable housing, you really don't have much to run on. So the way you win elections is simply mount horrendous character assaults against any person who stands in their way. And that's essentially what the attacks on Obama have been. So, you know, we can agree, disagree, and I disagree with a number of the president's policies. But you're quite right. This guy has tried to sit down and negotiate. He's not a divisive guy. And yet he has been attacked unmercifully. And with that, Ian, I have to apologize, but I've got to run out the door here.
And I look forward to seeing you later.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Senator Bernie Sanders, who was elected to the U.S. Senate in 2006 after serving 16 years in the House of Representatives. He is the longest-serving independent member of Congress in American history and sits on the Veterans Committee and was tapped by Senate leadership to be the ranking member of the Senate Budget Committee. He also serves on the Environment and Public Works and the Energy and Natural Resources, the Joint Economic, and on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committees. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the possible hidden motives behind Saudi intervention in Yemen. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Beirut is Lina Hatib, who is the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Previously, she was the co-founding head of the Program on Arab Reform and Democracy at Stanford University's Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lina Hatib.
Hello, thanks.
And Lina, the last time we spoke, you mentioned a possible scenario vis-a-vis Yemen, and that was that the Saudis have an interest in controlling the south of Yemen, particularly the port of Aden, where these oil terminals exist, and that the Saudi oil could be piped directly to Asian customers from terminals on the Indian Ocean, thus bypassing the Gulf and the Iranian-dominated Straits of Hormuz. I've run that by a few people, and most people are pretty skeptical. But what's happening now with a possible Saudi and Arab League land invasion, it's beginning to look like maybe you're onto something.
Well, yes. Saudi Arabia is now finally being decisive about Yemen and using this war against the Houthis to consolidate Saudi influence and control over Yemen, including the port of Aden, as you have just mentioned.
So do they have oil pipelines, though, from their oil fields that cross all across Saudi Arabia down? In other words, is there a land route for oil pipelines, or would they have to build one?
I'm not quite sure, to be honest with you, what the infrastructure is at the moment. But I do know that Saudi Arabia is certainly interested in having that scenario become a reality. Yemen is right next door to Saudi Arabia. It's a strategic country that has this opening onto the Indian Ocean, and that is too much of a good opportunity to be missed by Saudi Arabia. In addition, of course, to the political situation that Yemen offers Saudi Arabia, meaning that if Saudi Arabia manages to have control over Yemen, then it can minimize Iranian influence in the Gulf and restore Saudi influence in the area in a much more comprehensive way than before.
So it basically would take away Iranian leverage, military leverage over the Straits of Hormuz, which has always been a kind of nightmare scenario, that the Iranians could essentially bottle up the Gulf and close off the enormous supply of oil.
Yes, and this is something that Saudi Arabia has been trying to counter for some time, and this is only yet another way in which Saudi Arabia is trying to do that. Prior to this, we saw the establishment of a military base in Bahrain by the UK Navy, and establishing that base in that particular location was also something blessed by the Saudis, brokered by the Saudis as well as UAE, and aims at countering Iranian influence in that particular area.
So with this 22-nation Arab League agreement to form a joint Arab military force, which was agreed to at a summit in Egypt on Sunday, what is the next scenario in terms of boots on the ground? I mean, I've talked to a couple of specialists who say that the Saudi military has never been really tested. We know that they bought some of the most expensive and up-to-date equipment available for the longest time. But if they were to have to control the south of Yemen and somehow evict the Houthis, they would also have all kinds of problems with tribal people in the mountains. In other words, is their checkbook diplomacy sufficient that they can essentially buy off this incredibly poor country?
I think the Saudis are feeling fairly confident about this particular battle. They believe they can win it because they have the support of a number of other Arab countries, as well as Pakistan, as well as the backing of the international community. And also, they had led ground war in a way before when they sent troops to Bahrain to quell the uprising in 2011. So this is not the first time that Saudi Arabia has had to act on the ground. But this time, it's, of course, a very different scenario. It's an actual live conflict as opposed to the quelling of a rebellion. And Saudi Arabia is feeling empowered because it has this international and regional backing. The Houthis also are allied with Iran. However, they're not Iranian proxies, and therefore Iranian support for them is actually quite minimal. And it is likely that Iran is going to drop the Houthis for other higher returns in the Levant, mainly to do with the nuclear file as well as Syria. meaning that overwhelming the Houthis is not going to be very difficult for the Saudis. But of course, as you said, securing Yemen after that is going to be difficult because you have, in addition to the tribes, the presence of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. You also have the presence of Islamic State fighters. So this is by no means going to be an easy or a short war for Saudi Arabia.
And if they were successful, building these pipelines is a big undertaking, and even more to the point, securing them on a permanent basis is also a huge undertaking.
Yes, absolutely. But at the moment, I see Saudi aims as being primarily political in this battle. More than anything, Saudi Arabia seems to want to use Yemen as a political card in its rivalry with Iran. And as I said, if Saudi Arabia manages to control Yemen, then it can weaken Iranian influence in the Gulf and have the upper hand in negotiations with Iran on other issues such as the Syrian.
But you just mentioned that the Houthis are not, they keep referring to them as Iranian-backed, as though Iran is pulling the strings, that they're not really a proxy in the sense that they're micromanaged by Iran. So how much of this scenario is a result of Saudi Arabian paranoia?
It's not Saudi paranoia. If anything, what we're seeing today is the result of Saudi retreat in terms of political influence in the region. For a while, internal divisions within Saudi Arabia resulted in an incoherent foreign policy. So, for example, Saudi Arabia had channels of communication open with the Houthis while at the same time painting the Houthis as Iranian proxies and saying they are very dangerous and a threat to Saudi and Gulf security. And this kind of inconsistency meant that Saudi's role in regional politics retreated and allowed Iran and Qatar and other actors to try to occupy that that vacancy. But now Saudi Arabia has realized that it's basically Houthi rebellion was a wake-up call, and it is trying to reclaim its influence in the region. And Yemen is a very symbolic way of doing that.
So, Lena, do you think, though, that the deal that is getting close to being finalized in Switzerland between the P5 plus one and Iran, are there some hidden agendas in that deal, a possible sellout, if you will, of the Syrian rebellion? I'm not sure that that the West could stomach making a deal with Assad, but perhaps the Iranians could find a way to ease him out. Is that in the cards?
Not officially, but of course, behind the scenes, these kinds of conversations are taking place. Syria will be something very much linked to the nuclear file in the sense that if a deal happens on the nuclear issue, then this will increase Iranian confidence in the West. And Iran will, of course, have to give the West something in return for being accepted once again by the international community. And Syria may well be that card. And I think that the easiest sacrifice that Iran can do is Assad himself, getting rid of him in return for having some form of transitional government that still retains Iranian interests in the area. And I think what we're seeing here really is a case of almost a Cold War scenario between Saudi Arabia and Iran, whereby Saudi Arabia restores its influence over the Gulf while Iran is tolerated in increasing its own influence in the Levant, including Syria.
But obviously we have a schizophrenic policy vis-a-vis Iraq on the one hand, where we're working with the Iranians, and in Syria where we're working against their proxy, the Assads. And there are some concern that's been expressed by some of the few Arab specialists here in the United States who speak Arabic, that like Graham Fuller and Robert Baer and others that I've spoken with, and Richard Barrett as well, from formerly with MI6. And they all are very concerned about the fact that what's happening in Iraq is really a war on the Sunnis, and that even if they're successful in retaking Mosul, it'll be a pile of rubble, and you will have some very, very angry dislodged Sunnis that may end up impacting both Saudi Arabia and Jordan.
Yes, these are very legitimate concerns, and they are behind the recent slowing down of battles in Tikrit by the Iranian Hashd al-Shaabi, the Iraqi Hashd al-Shaabi, which is the group of Shia militias who are fighting the Islamic State organization in that area. The reason why the fighting has slowed down in Tikrit is because the fight against Islamic State is beginning to be viewed in sectarian terms as a Shia versus Sunni issue, which bears bad news for the stability of Iraq in the long term. So I think really the U.S. has to play it very sensitively here. It cannot afford to be seen as allying itself with Iran against Islamic State, but at the same time, it has to give Iran something. But I think a compromise scenario is possible. It's not black and white. As long as Sunni tribes and Sunnis in Iraq are engaged in the war against extremism, I think this would be a good way forward so that the fight can involve Iraqis as Iraqis and not as ethnic or sectarian communities. And this also means having in place a governance system in Iraq that retains the rights of all its ethnic and sectarian entities. When it comes to Syria, as I said, the only way forward will have to be a compromise between Iran and the U.S. and Saudi Arabia. And I think that is not impossible, but what's needed is some serious dialogue about what form this compromise can take. And unfortunately, at the moment, we're still far from reaching that kind of scenario and that conversation.
Well, my understanding is that al-Maliki is still a power behind the scenes in Baghdad, and that General Allen and the U.S. have not been receptive to calls for the longest time from the Sunni tribes in the region that is controlled by the Islamic State. It's impossible to believe that a few thousand Mad Max lunatics driving around in Toyota pickup trucks are controlling all of that area. But apparently so far, the U.S. has been unwilling to deal with the tribes. That's my understanding.
Yeah, unfortunately. And this is something that is really that should be an issue of urgency, because restoring trust among Iraqis is the only way that Iraq can be stabilized. But at the moment, we are seeing lack of trust between all the different factions that are fighting ISIS, including even within the Kurdish community. I mean, the Kurds are fighting ISIS, but not in a unified way. The different political parties in Kurdistan are doing it on their own. They all happen to be fighting the same enemy, but they're still engaged in political rivalries. So Iraq really needs a very comprehensive long-term plan to deal with its political complexities. And Maliki, as long as he's involved in the scene, may well end up like President Saleh of Yemen. And as we can see, Saleh was ousted from power in a kind of negotiated transition, but he's now teamed up with the Houthis in an attempt at restoring his power. And Maliki in Iraq is basically doing the same thing at the moment. He was removed from his position as prime minister, but he's trying to regain influence through supporting these Shia militias.
And we know from a report in Forbes magazine that Saleh, in the deposed leader of Yemen, stole at least $30 billion, perhaps even more. I don't know how much money al-Maliki has squirreled away, but we know that a lot of the oil revenues that Iraq has been getting since the Iraq war have not reached the Iraqi people, shall we say. So, you know, it sounds like these kleptocrats not just feathered their own nests, they've also have so much money that they can create mischief.
Yes, absolutely. And both of them are similar in that they have created private armies with this money, and also, unfortunately, using military aid given to Iraq and Yemen, respectively, by the United States. Both of them courted the U.S. and the West in general by presenting themselves as partners in the war against terrorism. And they got lots of money as a result, lots of military support, but they used it for their own personal gains. And here the mistake of the West comes in allowing these people to rule without having measures of good governance attached to having them in place. So Saleh was a friend of the U.S. for a very long time because he said he is a partner in the war on terror. He allowed the U.S. to attack al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula through drones. Same thing with Maliki. He said he is fighting extremist jihadists in Iraq. But this support for the U.S. did not come with measures saying there has to be accountability, there has to be real pluralism and power sharing. None of those things were made as a condition of support. And now everybody is paying the price as a result.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Lina Hatib.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Lina Hatib, who's the director of the Carnegie Middle East Center in Beirut. Previously, she was the co-founding head of the Program on Arab Reform and Democracy at Stanford University's Center on Democracy Development and the Rule of Law. And we're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about whether or not the German wing's crash could have been avoided. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is James Fellows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He previously worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter and was editor of U.S. News and World Report. His books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress? Breaking the News, How the Media Undermine American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. He has an article at The Atlantic, Could the German Wings Crash Have Been Avoided? Welcome to Background Briefing, James Fellows.
Ian, it's nice to talk to you again.
And likewise, James, and you're an instrument-rated pilot, and I believe that you've been flying around or plan to fly around all over the United States into small towns and drop in on little airfields and do a kind of portrait of America. As a sort of aerial vagabond, I guess. Is that,
yes.
Have I characterized it correctly?
Yes. Actually, for the past year plus, my wife Deb and I have been flying around the country in our little Cirrus airplane, doing reports for The Atlantic and sometimes with Marketplace Radio and sometimes magazine articles about the ways in which cities that have had some kind of economic or political challenge have responded to that. For example, recently we've been in Fresno, California's Central Valley, which has every problem the Central Valley cities have, and the ways in which people are trying to rebuild its economy, to connect its workforce with new opportunities, et cetera. It's been a lot of fun.
Well, I'd like to talk more about that, but let's deal with the German Wings crash and much of the evidence that's coming out now about the pilot's psychological state and the extent to which he hid it from both Lufthansa, his employer, and from whatever regulators or unions or whatever regulation he is under. My understanding is, and perhaps I'm wrong, but it certainly should be the case, James Fellows, that if you're on any kind of medication and you're an airline pilot, wouldn't you have to report that?
Yes, and I think there's I've been hearing from a lot of professional pilots and medical examiners over the last couple of days and quoting some of their responses on the Atlantic site, and they point out there's really a perverse incentive system built into the medical certification problem now, because the way that the FAA regulations work in the U.S. and with analogs around the world is that if you report you're getting treatment for some kind of mental disease, or especially if you're on any kind of medication, that is usually automatically disqualifying for roles as a professional pilot. And so you can see the benefit of that, but also that the downside is that for many pilots, it means they don't get treated. And that's something that, so people who might, with medication, be perfectly able to do this job and many others end up not avoiding treatment, avoiding medication, and having the only drug they are allowed to take is alcohol. So I think this is going to be a next subject of scrutiny, not, you know, cockpit safety so much, but how the aviation system can properly check people without creating these perverse incentives.
But are pilots currently expected to sort of reveal it themselves? Is it their personal obligation to tell whoever it is they have to tell that they're on some kind of medication and that they have some kind of problem?
there's a sort of inspection track and then a self-reporting track. The inspection track is, depending on the kind of pilot you are, you have to take exams every so often. For a private pilot like me, it's every 2 years, or if you're a very young person, it's every 5 years. For airline pilots, they usually have to take examinations every 6 months, and they're pretty demanding examinations. There are EKGs, and there's blood pressure and extensive vision tests and all of that. So they are examined every 6 months, but also they are obliged, they're supposed to report, self-report any problem, any medication, anything else. And so they can't avoid being inspected every 6 months. What they can avoid is not going to seek a treatment for some kind of psychological problem, or not seeking out any kind of medication, because they would be legally required to report that. So to avoid breaking the law that way, they don't get help. They don't look for help.
So how much did the Lufthansa know about this co-pilot's medical condition?
Without knowing in specific about this case, what any airline would know is what the official record is. And so this is something that at any level of piloting, including amateurs like me, you have to report to the FAA or the European bodies at these regular intervals and make a public declaration of any medication you're on, any condition you've had, all the recent doctor appointments you've had. And so Lufthansa would have had access to all of that, and also to the results of the government the government mandated inspection, which this pilot would have had to have every 6 months. So they would know what was officially on the record. They wouldn't know anything either that he had chosen, any treatment he had chosen not to get, or any treatment he got on the sly someplace and chose not to report. So that again is the whole, it's the tension of the system. It relies, as does much of aviation, on a certain degree of trust and expected honorable behavior by people within it.
So in this case where investigators have found antidepressant drugs in the co-pilot's home, would that have ever shown up? I mean, that's a flag, isn't it?
Yes. And it's if he was taking those drugs and not reporting them, he was breaking the law. And, you know, the law is you are I can't think of the exact analogies in other parts of life, but you are required to sign an affidavit, sort of like an income tax thing, saying that you have been complete and honest in reporting all aspects of your medical condition. So it's a violation of the law for him not to have reported that, but obviously that's a lesser problem than the one he caused. And again, the point I'm making is that there's a contradiction built into the medical licensing system now, where pilots know they will no longer be able to do their job if they report they're getting treatment for some certain kinds of mental or other illnesses. Therefore, they don't report it, and they find ways to go around the system.
And again, I'm speaking with James Fallows, who's an award-winning author and national correspondent for The Atlantic. He previously worked as President Carter's chief speechwriter and was editor of U.S. News and World Report. And his books on media and politics include Who Runs Congress? Breaking the News, How the Media Undermines American Democracy, Blind into Baghdad, America's War in Iraq, and his latest, China Airborne, The Test of China's Future. He also has an article at The Atlantic, Could the German Wings Crash Have Been Avoided? And in terms of avoiding the crash, your piece at The Atlantic, James Fallows, talks a lot about the cockpit door issue. Of course, the cockpit door after 9/11 was designed to keep bad people out of the cockpit, as opposed to keeping good people out of the cockpit, which is the case with the chief pilot who was trying to break the door down. I believe he even tried to go at it with an axe. And obviously, that sound on the flight recorder must be horrific. But that's the evidence that led us all to the conclusion of what really happened there. Is there any way around that? There doesn't appear to be a technical fix here, does there?
I think the main reason I was doing that item in The Atlantic was to say there's a natural impulse after these disasters, which are so horrific and which are even more imaginatively powerful in their horror than the fact that, you know, probably more people died on the highways in that 24 hours than died in the airplane crash, but somehow there's an additional horror to it happening this way. Do resist the impulse to think, oh, if only we had this new rule or this new safety gimmick, this would not have happened, because at a certain level, you cannot prevent a pilot who is in a position of trust necessarily, but decides for whatever reason to carry out this murderous plot. There really is not a system or a device that's going to prevent that. And again, if the problem with these the cockpit doors is they have to simultaneously be strong enough to resist, you know, as you say, to keep the bad people out, but there has to be some way to override them for an emergency in which a pilot passed out and the other one had to go in and give him help or whatever. So I think that the attention returns properly to the human factors here, and the way that ultimately you have to place trust in the people who are flying these airplanes, just as people who are performing medical surgery or people driving buses or railroads, that in the end you can't devise a system that will be foolproof against human malice in this form, and you have to concentrate on the human beings, in my view.
So another aspect that occurred to me is that the profession of airline pilots over the last few decades has definitely been downsized. They were a much higher paid, and I think they had greater professional respect. And we know from some of the revelations, I think, of the crash up in Buffalo, New York, the commuter airliners, that the pilots in that case were paid, you know, less than a living wage.
Yes, $16,000 for the first officer on that flight.
And apparently, in the case of I don't know how much if this applies to the co-pilot of the German Wings plane, but I know apparently from talking to some people in the aviation industry that pilot training nowadays costs a fortune, and it's somewhat akin to student loan debt. That you go to these schools in Arizona, etc., and you run up this huge debt, then you have to work off the debt. And it reminds me again of students where they have this, what they call boomerang kids that have so much student debt they come back home to live with their parents. He was living with his parents. Is that an issue there that he was?
Yes. I think the most fruitful attention after this episode would be on the structural economic issues affecting the airline industry as opposed to cockpit doors and things like that. On the one hand, we have to recognize that commercial aviation is almost unbelievably safe. Even with these horrors we've seen with this latest crash and the Malaysian disappearance and all that, it still is the case that commercial airlines flight worldwide is safer than it's ever been in history and safer than almost anything else you can do with your time. So on the one hand, that is true. On the other hand, there's been over the last generation a relentless pressure on all parts of the airline system to keep costs lower and lower and lower, as we know from what it's like to be jammed into the seats, of the fees for the extra bags and everything. And also the economic pressures on the piloting community. There was a time 30 or 40 years ago this was quite an elite job. For some of the big international carriers, it still is that way. But for all these commuter lines that are coming up around the world, it's quite a low-level economic position. And so you have a kind of de-skilling and pressure on people. And one ramification is having people in positions like this young man who was the first officer on a flight with a very low amount of total flight time and very low pay, as we know from living with his parents. And so I hope there'll be some attention on, have we gone too far in sort of the Walmartization of air travel? And will we start seeing some safety effects if we continue in that direction?
Well, isn't it the case, James Fellows, that some of these trainee pilots with this student debt from learning to fly, they basically become unpaid interns, and that's how they work up their hours?
There's a horrible scheme called P2F, or pay to fly, that I think is getting phased out now, which was like something out of the Dickensian era, where these people who wanted to make a career as pilots, they'd be paying tens of thousands of dollars a year to a flight school, and simultaneously they'd be kind of contracted out as first officers to other airlines. So while these people were paying the flight school, they were essentially working as free pilots for airline, free, you know, co-pilots. They weren't in command of the airplane, but still they were doing the work while paying to do it. That, fortunately, is now being phased out and is recognized as a sort of, as I say, a Mr. Grad Grind abuse. But overall, it's a hard road for people to get into flying, especially when, compared to 30 years ago, there were fewer people whom the military trained for free. You know, that was the tradition for a long time after World War II. You had this big supply of military-trained pilots. There are fewer of them now, and it's a more costly way for the individual pilot to get in. I can tell you, if you want, the difference between the European and the U.S. approach, but it's basically a hard road for people to go down now.
Well, tell us the difference.
So many of your listeners will remember back in 2009, there was a terrible crash outside Buffalo, which you and I discussed a minute ago. And one of the ramifications of that was to say that there needed to be higher training requirements for the so-called first officer. This is what often is referred to as the co-pilot. Usually the person who sits in the left-hand seat of the plane is the captain, is the more experienced pilot. The right-hand seat is the first officer or co-pilot. And until that crash in Buffalo, the requirements for that job were to have only a commercial flying certificate, which required only 250 hours of flying time, which is not much at all. After the Colgan crash, which was basically a pilot error situation, the FAA said that both of the pilots needed to have what's called an airline transport certificate, which requires 1,500 hours of experience and means you just have seen more of the flying world but before doing that. Europe has had a different approach where they, since there is less of a sort of flying culture in Europe and less of a military flying culture, many of the airlines there have begun what they call ab initio training. Well, they'll hire somebody who has no flying experience whatsoever. They'll send him to flight school first in Europe, then usually in Arizona or Florida, and then get them into the cockpit with, again, maybe only a couple hundred hours of experience, like this young man in Germany. And the Europeans have thought they could sort of grow their own pilots and teach them, even if they didn't have that much experience, versus the U.S. approach of requiring just more bulk experience, however you get it. And I think there'll be some reconsideration of that now in Germany, because, again, the man who crashed the plane in Germany had only 630 hours of total flying time, which is not very much.
And when you mention pilot error, of course, we've seen examples of that, of the TransAsia air crash in Taiwan video, yes, which was shown a lot, and the Asiana crash at San, yes, Francisco, where there was clearly a pilot error involved. I'd just like to turn a little bit, because in our earlier conversation with Senator Bernie Sanders, I asked him about the kind of poisonous political atmosphere in this country and the extent to which the Republican right has given, in effect, the American people permission to hate this president, which is clearly the case. And I think the last election, most of the gains that the Republicans made in the Senate, if you look at the campaigns on television, they were all basically running against the black man. It was pretty shameful. You've been around Washington a long time. You were President Carter's chief speechwriter. What's your explanation for this? Because this man, this president, is not a divisive figure like Richard Nixon. He seems like a sincere guy who's trying to do the best he can. And I do not for the life of me understand why he elicits such poisonous hatred.
That is a good question, which maybe, you know, 5 or 6 years from now, when Obama is out of office, he may be able to speak to with some more openness than he can now. I think you have the coincidence of a couple of cycles in American life and history which happen to be accentuating each other in a bad way right now. One is the cycle of ethnic change in the United States, which is going We're both in California right now as we're speaking. I'm from California originally. California, when I grew up in the Pat Brown era, was a mainly white state. Now it's a majority-minority state. I view this as the glory of the United States, that it can incorporate talent from all around the world, even including you, and kind of make this be the arena where people can fulfill things they couldn't do elsewhere. But through history in the United States and elsewhere, ethnic change has often been disruptive for the group that feels it's on the losing end. So there is some kind of there's an understandable older white reaction in this way. There's the long cycle of racial politics in the United States, where the fact of a first black president, it would have to have been someone as conciliatory as Obama has been or as Colin Powell would have been, but still it is disruptive. And then you also have the Republican Party, which in my view is still on a long pendulum swing towards an extreme that has not yet been arrested. I think it won't be arrested until the Republicans decide that they care about winning the presidency, which they'll never be able to do as long as they are concentrating so much on older white Southern voters. But at the moment, their statewide success in the Senate and governorships can be accelerated by sort of having this divisive message. And so Obama has been in the middle of this. And one other thing, I think that there's been a lot of attention recently to the way that the politics of Israel have become partisanized in a way they didn't used to be, where the Republican Party is becoming the pro-Netanyahu party. And that has sort of poisonously become, as Obama has been cast as the villain there, insanely, but that's how it's happened. There's been a fair amount of racial animus in that, too. So I think it is a difficult moment in our national history where the Republicans are hurting the country while also hurting themselves, and Obama has navigated it as best he can.
And we've already, in terms of the 2016 race, if the Democrats don't retain the White House, then we'll have a very different country. The Republican control of all branches of government, since they clearly control the Supreme Court, at least conservatives do. So looking at that, I mentioned to Senator Sanders that it's a bit odd that we, on the Republican side, you get about 20 people jumping into the ring with Cruz already in, yep, and Rubio coming in next week and so on. So on and so forth. On the Democratic side, it's a monologue, not a dialogue at this point.
Right.
With Hillary, what do you think can happen there? And of course, Bernie Sanders has a dilemma. He's a independent, but he wants to be in the Democratic debates.
And I hope that he runs. I hope that Martin O'Malley runs. I hope that my longtime friend Jim Webb runs, because I think the country is better off, the Democratic Party is better off, and the now apparently presumptive nominee Hillary Clinton would be better off for the fact of a debate and for the fact of a contest. And they're sort of, so if on the one hand Hillary Clinton, as now seems, let me back up a second. There's never been a situation like this before in presidential politics that I'm aware of where a non-incumbent was such a presumptive favor for the nomination as Hillary Clinton is now. It just, there's never been anything like this. And so you can't, and it would be better, however this plays out, if there is a challenge among the Democrats, I think. On the Republican side, what is to me striking is that you have this very wide and active field where, on form, none of them seems electable on a national basis. If you look at the Electoral College configuration of starting with California and New York and the block of states that it's really hard for a Republican hardliner to take, you have a very competitive race for what seems like a sort of poison chalice of trying to win on this very right-wing platform nationally. So we'll see how this goes, but I hope that Senator Sanders joins the race. I hope that Governor O'Malley joins the race and that former Senator Webb join the race. I think Hillary Clinton would be better off, and so would be the rest. So would the rest of us.
And of course, there's a clamor for Elizabeth Warren to join. It seems unlucky that she will, and she's tried to make that clear. But obviously, people aren't listening. But it's interesting to note that Citibank has held up giving money to the Democratic senatorial campaigns. And the other big five Wall Street banks are apparently threatening not to fund the Democrats until they rein in Elizabeth Warren.
If they actually come through on that, that would sort of that would fulfill every every harsh stereotype you could have of the greed of the financial community, because they're about to have Chuck Schumer as the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. Hillary Clinton has been anything but hostile to the interest of finance in the United States, nor has the Democratic Party. And so if the financial leadership of this country is willing to bring on essentially the anti-science forces in American life out of spite about, you know, this or that concern with Elizabeth Warren, then God save us all.
Well, I asked you earlier about a long-term perspective on why the polity is so poisonous at the moment. And is there also a case here to be made that over the decades, the center of power, which has always been in Washington, has gravitated to New York, to Wall Street? How would you rate the balance of power between the power of Wall Street and the power of Washington?
I'm a believer in not long cycles of history, but certain resemblances. And I think that almost everything that is a problem now, we can see in the America of approximately 1875 through 1915, the first Gilded Age, whether it's the power of Wall Street or the power of concentrated industry or the power of various racist groups or immigrant tensions or all of that. So I think we are at another high point of financial power, which has been aggravated because of these egregious Supreme Court rulings in the past half dozen years. So it is a high point, but it's not an unprecedented point. And that's why I think the most rewarding historical reading these days is of the populist and progressive and environmental era 100 plus years ago, because that was in response to essentially the same circumstances we have now. So it is a challenge, but it's not the only time the U.S. has dealt with this kind of challenge.
So if the pendulum swings between plutocracy and democracy, when is it going to swing back to democracy?
Well, good question. I would have two markers here. One is the appointment of the next two or three justices of the Supreme Court will be enormously important, because when the balance switches on the Supreme Court, this can be a different country. The Citizens United would go the different way, et cetera. So that depends on who's the next incumbent in the White House. The other is when the Republican Party decides that they care about the presidency. And maybe that would be after the next census, when in redistricting they wouldn't have this gerrymandered stranglehold on the House of Representatives. And presumably the next two senatorial elections will be less favorable for them than the last one was. So I think there are pressures on the Republican Party that make them think they care about reaching women and minorities again. So that's what I'd be looking for.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, James Fellows.
Thanks, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with James Fellows, an award-winning author and national correspondent at The Atlantic. He was previously President Carter's chief speechwriter and was editor of U.S. News and World Report, and has an article at The Atlantic, Could the German Wings Crash Have Been Avoided? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.